Possible for it.
No way.
See, I said if I had one person, I'd everyone think, well, I was that one person, and I have to think, because I've asked anyone else if they voted for it. No, so it was actually, I think there were three who won the, not everyone voted for me. So there were three so far that actually won the assignment, and I think I've got four no's. But there's, like, more than 70 people for us, so it's... So it depends on whether I interpret the non-votes as yeses or no's, so... So I'll give you a little more time to maybe vote on that before. Because I thought it was going to be everybody saying no or everybody saying yes, and since you guys are divided, and it's really important that you vote if you haven't voted already. Otherwise, I'll just have to choose. And topic-wise, someone said at the end of the class last time, and it's true, that I shouldn't let you off QCD quickly, because it is true that this is the time in your life you're taking a standard model course. You should see it's some QCD. So I'll give you the bare bones of the QCD sections, even though that wasn't one of the topics we had on our list. So my plan now would be that we'll do the loops, we'll do the QCD, and I think we could probably do a topic every day, more or less. So I might not survive, but it's... And then whatever the next topic was after that, I'll do. So the only thing I would add is a kind of a sketch of the QCD. One day would be the QCD. Unless there's a problem. It's good for your teeth and bones.
So, sorry, before you start, I found another error in the textbook.
Oh, yeah? Can you email it to me? Because that would be written down.
It's a question 7.1.
Oh, is it a typo or is it a major?
It's probably a typo.
Oh, they're running the maps?
Yeah, but it refers to problem 5.2, which should be referring to
5.3. Oh, okay. So, yeah, if you can email me that, I'll put that on the list. Are you calculating this running? That's great.
I accidentally did before I realized that was the problem.
Yeah, so I'm also going to be, so I'm more or less following the section in chapter 7 here, but I'm actually following the notes, my own notes on the calculation rather than literally what's in here. So the section we're talking about is the discussion around equation 7.25. And the following section where the vacuum polarization is calculated. So 7.26 is the formula. So it's going to reproduce a lot of the stuff that's there, but it might be just different from the video. Anything else you want to ask before I start? All right, so we wanted to do a loop example. And so let's imagine we're interested in scattering of like an electron in the helium or something. And so let's just think of electromagnetism. So the basic scattering was that channel. Because these particles are different, we don't have to worry about the other kind of channel we should have had. I want to look at one of the corrections to that, which is this particular one. To do with an electron or a muon going around this, these are photons everywhere. And so let me write down the amplitude for this for the Feynman rules. Just so we can compare them. You can see that a lot of the things that are in here are already here, right? So everything to do with the external lines, the vertices here, one of these propagators is already here. And then the only thing that's essentially new is would be, let's say, here on here is the new part of this graph. And I want to, at the end of the day, just write the formula for this contribution, because that's the thing that has all the guts of what we're trying to do. So the amplitude here would have been, you know, using our S matrix, it's going to be in the final state, you've got an electron, say the momentum, let's say the momentum coming through here is P, P prime, K, and K prime. So we've got a final state would be electron, P prime. So there's a second order graph, right? So we've got 1 over 2 factorial as a factor of minus I squared, because we get the second order interaction. If we ask how many ways to string these graphs together, there's essentially one way, because the vertices we had to start out with would have been an electron and a photon, a muon and a photon, and we know what the initial and final states are. So we had no option as to how we connect these lines. And then there's no option in how we connect those lines. So there's the statistical number of ways you can string the elements together to get the graph factor is 1. Now we start working our way along the fermion line backwards, right? So we have a spinner U bar, K prime. And we have a vertex here, which you remember the relevant interactions for electromagnetism, I, E, fermion bar, gamma mu, charge of the fermion. Yep. Same. So we have, well, in the gamma matrix, we have gamma mu. In this case, the charge, let's say if these electrons mu on the charge is minus 1, we're going to get 2 powers of that, because there's 1 in each end, so that the charge is going to square up to 1. We have gamma mu, then we have the spinner. The incoming muon, and we have the same thing on the other fermion line. And then we have this propagator for the photon, and the photon was, we can use the gauge word, that's it we knew divided by the momentum in here. If this is K coming in, K prime coming out, P coming in and P prime coming out, we can think of this as being, it's either P prime minus P, or it's K prime minus K. K minus K prime. So that's what this would have been, right? And there's the 2 pi and the delta functions. We have 2 vertices. We have a pi to the fourth, delta to the fourth. Actually, I'm going on 1 step ahead of myself. If we just call this q, let's just do that first. Q squared. We have delta q minus p prime plus p. And we have the other vertex with the delta q. And then we would have the integral over q, which is 1 over pi to the fourth times minus I. You guys could have complained here, this is plus pi squared, right? And that's because there's a we have a minus I for each power of the Hamiltonian, but the Hamiltonian was minus the Lagrangian. So we have I for each interaction. We have minus I for each propagator. Minus I, right before. And there's an integral before q. And that's what the Feynman rules were, if you remember. Right, so we can just, that's the usual thing. The integral over q, we do the delta function with.
Yeah. Missing Putnam constants and
we're missing a couple of them. And
phase space integrals and
The phase space integrals will come when I stick this thing into a cross section. So this thing will be squared and we'll have an integral.
Okay, yeah, sorry.
But it's true that I'm missing a couple of constants, so I need a vector b squared. And it's the usual story that the integral here does one of the delta functions. And that's what allowed me to write this q the way I wrote it, being p times minus p squared. And then this minus I, 2 pi to the fourth, takes out 2 pi to the fourth and takes out I. And so at the end of the day, we're left with I p squared. 2 pi to the fourth of p plus k minus p times the spinner's factors. That was that one. So the only thing that's new here is so all that stuff is still there, right? But in that second graph, we're just going to have more factors of the. Let's just write it out here. So the second one will be the same thing, like e. Remind me of the graphs again. So we call that Q. In principle, if I go back to the original step where I'm assigning a different momentum for everybody, I call this one L, I call this one R, and that one S, let's say. So what we would have had here is we're going to have a four factor of E. We're going to have a factor of, there's a 1, 2, 3, 4 factorial fourth order graph. I'll write the I's of the 2, 5, and 4 so I get them. We have to kind of have a statistics factor as to how many ways we can string this graph together. So we have the, let's just take this guy here to be, to make life easy for ourselves, let's say that this is an electron, this is a muon, and this is a tau. So they're all distinct. Because once we've done that, then there's only one unique way of connecting all the fermion lines. And the only issue is how many ways can we connect the photon stuff. So we would have had this. And so there's to get this graph, if we connect this guy to this guy, and this guy to this guy, we're going to get a graph which is not this graph. We're going to get instead the graph. We can get this graph from these ingredients. We don't want to count that as a contribution to this. So to get this graph, I have to connect this guy to one of those two ends. So there's a factor of 2 there. And once I've done that, the other connection is 3. So there's two ways to get the graph from what we started off with. And this is actually something that I don't know if I told you this properly before. I think I left a rule out. I'm giving you guys the rule. One way to think of this, that these vertices here is that we have we're looking at an exponential of I times Lagrangian, right, which was pretty e to the minus I times the Hamiltonian. And the Lagrangian is a tau coupling to A, is a muon coupling to A, and an electron coupling to A. So if I imagine expanding this, what we're doing is we're expanding this up to the powers of there's a coupling constant here, E, which is important to be the same as that. So let me write this as tau, E bar mu, E bar E. And what we're doing is we're expanding this in powers of E. So with the expansion of an exponential, the term that would have all three of these things is going to come from piece, which is tau bar tau a plus e bar mu a plus e bar e a cubed over 3 factorial. And there's an I here, so we have I cubed. Right? So I've written the I wanted actually 2 of the first, right? So I have the fourth power. I've written the eye of the fourth. I'll write it there now. The four factorial, but there's, when I expand this power out, right, there's a, I'm looking for a thing that has this thing twice, this once, and this once. And if I expand this out, this you know, if I expanded, you know, x plus y squared out, I would have had x squared plus 2xy plus y squared. And that 2 is a combinatorial factor that is telling you the number of ways in which you could have expanded out this Hamiltonian and gotten two vertices of this, or in this case, one vertex of this, one vertex of that. And we have to keep track of this numerical factor here. So what we need to know is, in this power to the fourth, what's the coefficient of this squared times this, right? And that's going to be, so let's imagine we think of it as a binomial. If this one plus this one, we want something linear here, it's going to be p3 1 is so we have the overall r to the fourth over 4 factorial, and then we'll have 4 times e bar e a, and then tau a plus u bar u a cubed plus all the terms. And then here we want to focus on the term where we have one of these mu bar mu, so we're going to expand that thing out, we're going to get a factor of 3. 4 times 3 times we'll have this squared times mu bar mu a plus. So there's a factor of 4 times 3 in the number of ways in which we can get these particular vertices to try and contract, given that we're expanding an exponential of the Hamiltonian. Once we had those vertices, we had this factor of 2 coming from the number of ways we could string the photon together. So altogether, you see we're getting a factor of 4 factorial from the ways we can combine the vertices and the ways in which we can get those vertices from the expansion of the Hamiltonian. And I think this factor here, the rules I told you before, isn't included in it. I was pulling them off the top of my head when I gave them to you, and I think I might have forgotten to give you that factor explicitly. I told you you had to count the statistics factor, but I didn't actually do an explicit example where you saw that it's more than just taking the given vertices and stringing together the lines in all possible ways. There's actually also a factor in how, in the expansion of e to the I action, how many ways can you get this number of specific kinds of vertices to be taken to the matrix element. Is it clear where this number is coming from? I think the 4 times 3.
Another question about just the connection. Is it another breath if you were to make the loop go? I don't know if it's the same. Is it another breath if you were to make the fermion flow go in the opposite direction? Or is that equivalent to switching the photon to the other side?
That's a little bit efficient as well on the other side.
Okay.
And then the factor 2 I missed here for the same reason, right? Here I needed to have a muon vertex and a tau and an electron vertex in something which was this. I had basically the sum of those things squared. So I'm picking off the cross term of one electron and one muon. There's two ways that can happen. What's really saying is that that's like saying that there's a, we could have had the mu bar mu a evaluated x and the e bar e a evaluated y, the time ordering of those things. We're integrating over x and y. And the thing is that this could be an x, this could be y, or this could be y, this could be an x. That's the two. That's one way of thinking with the two I'm talking about here. So the bottom line is that in both cases, the denominator is canceling off the statistics factor. That's the main result. So I'm going to write this I to the fourth when I write the delta function. The spinners are the same as before, right? We have u bar k, gamma mu, u bar prime, u bar p, mu, u p prime. Then we have the two, we write the integrals over all the momentum. We have the integral d4l, d4r, d4s, d4q, all these guys. We have, for each propagator, there's four of them, we have 1 over 2 pi to the fourth times I. For each vertex, we have an I and occupy the floor. This is the aisle that I was writing over here before. Did I get that right? 1, 2, 3, 4. There's a delta function for each vertex. So we've got delta 4 of q prime minus p minus l. Delta 4 of l plus s plus r. Q plus s plus r. So, and that'll be the propagators here. So we'll have eta mu alpha over L squared minus pi epsilon. That's that one. And then here we'll have eta nu beta over Q squared minus pi epsilon. And now we need this thing. So let's say we're going to go fermion around that. Left in that direction. We have a Fermion loop that always causes a sign. And because it's a loop, here the line began or end on a spinner, right? There was a, we had a U bar or a U. The loops that close on themselves are a trace in Dirac space because the contraction of the Dirac matrix here is with the spinner indices here. But if we followed the Dirac indices around here, we're always summing one matrix on another matrix on another matrix on another matrix. At the end of the day, we're taking the initial index is the same as the final index, and then we're summing that. So we're going to get a trace here in Dirac space. Let's start here. So this is the index alpha. That was the one that went with, or sorry, beta. That's the one that went with. Nu beta was the one that had momentum q, and mu was, sorry. This is the index nu, beta, alpha, and mu. This is confusing because this mu here is the particle mu. So we have a gamma beta. Working our way around backwards around the line, we would have a propagator here for the fermion. So that was minus I r slash plus the mass divided by r squared plus the mass squared minus I epsilon. We have the other vertex, gamma alpha. I'm surprised. I'm, 1, 2, 3. The two pi's bother me. We had one propagator and two vertices. That's why there's a two pi left over here, right? Here we've got 1, 2, 3, 4 propagators, 1, 2, 3, 4 vertices. I guess I shouldn't be surprised. No, that's okay. No, that is okay. So first thing we do is we do all the integrals, right? So we know that there's we've got 1, 2, 3, 4 delta functions. There are 4 integrals to do. But we know that one of these delta functions is going to survive as the overall energy momentum conservation of the delta function. So we're going to be left with one integral left. So let's do 3 of the integrals. Let's do all but the R integral, let's say. So we'll do this one using delta functions. So we're going to get minus e to the fourth. I'll cancel the two pi's and poke the i's out. So we get minus 2 to the 4. And those cancel down. The spinner factors. There's two left in integral for r. Oh, before I do that, I'll write the delta function. So we know that we're going to have left with delta function k prime. P prime minus K minus P integral 4R eta mu alpha. Well, L I can always express in terms of the delta function makes it L is equal to P prime minus P the same logic as it's k minus k prime. And then we have this trace still, so let's I R is R, so let's keep it. And now S is, in terms of the things we have, S is R minus L, right? So we can also, we don't want to keep R, but Q or L, so let's keep. I guess the 6 and 1 half together. So Q is basically Q is the same as L. So any momentum going in here is going to split, but it's going to come out again as L. So I might as well just write it this, the same way. So it's prime minus P slash. So you see there's a lot of common factors there. What I'd like to do is write them one as being, I want to identify the thing that was, let's call this thing, I want to take as the overall factor what we had here. So we have I. T squared. The two for that cancel. Squared pi bar theta mu. Well, theta mu doesn't really work very well, but I can have the 1 over p prime minus p squared and pi of squared. And this is all times, curly bracket, the first term is theta mu, and that's that thing. And now, down here we have something I want to call. Here, where I get the conventions right. I think it's going to be right. I call it. And pi mu depends on the pi mu is basically this factor here. And k minus k prime, I could have equally well written that as being p prime minus p again, using momentum conservation. And so having done that, I've got an integral, there's an r here, but I'm integrating over r anyway, so the only variable that's left of this thing is p minus p prime minus p, right? So this whole thing is a function of p prime minus p. So let's just call that p prime minus p was q, or it was k, or it was l, whatever it was. Let's just write down what it is here. So you have we had an I. We wanted a minus e. We got a I e squared. We go p four r over 2 pi to the 4th because I got 2 pi to the 4th here. I don't want to have one in the answer. These guys turn into these guys, so I can. This is the trace of gamma mu, or beta becomes mu, sorry. haven't done something specific, so. Oh, I'm on drugs. This can't be right, right? This is this. What I wrote there was the momentum of this line, but I'm describing the propagator on this line. That should have been S. And so S is S. I can think of it as being R minus L. Let's do it that way.
You're just trying to carve from what you have, right?
Yeah. So this is R minus L was. L is Q minus P prime, right? So for this
one is.
Did I get the sign wrong on one of those?
It should be L minus option.
Are we talking about this line or this line?
I used the first one before that. Should that be L minus one instead of R minus L?
I'm thinking that the R came in and then S and L both left.
Okay.
So S plus L have to be equal to R. That's how I got that.
Okay.
And then the same thing, L and P came in, and P prime came out. So L is P prime minus P. So I got this one. This should have been minus I R slash. Plus I, P prime minus P slash. So this becomes minus I, R slash. Minus Q slash. Somehow I get a sign mistake here. Signs are the bane of your existence, though, these things. So I should have a minus sign here because the. Where did I lose a sign? What I've been doing is I've been taking each vertex is giving me a plus I. Oh, what's not the, I know what it is. I haven't been keeping track of that. Right, because the I was following was the one that we had e to the minus I Hamiltonian, which was e to the I Lagrangian, and that I have been following around religiously. So that's why I had I to the fourth and this one and I squared and that one. But then where I wrote E here, I should have been keeping I. That's another I, right? That's in the Lagrangian, and the one I was calling was the one that was I times the Lagrangian. So I got to track this overall minus on here. Because it's an I squared. And here I would have had I E to the fourth, but I to the fourth is one anyway, so nothing changes here. So because of that, you get a minus here, because that changes the sign of this thing. That's disagrees with my notes. So this is what we want to talk about. This is called an active polarization. So this really now this is just a bunch of tricks. So the first trick is, you know, life would be so simple if the denominator here, so the, all the Dirac stuff is a numerator, right? The stuff in the denominators is a number. So you know, you could write this as being minus I d squared
n mu nu over d. D is just r squared plus n squared minus I epsilon r minus q. And n mu nu is this trace. It's the trace of gamma nu minus I r slash plus n gamma nu minus I r slash plus q slash.
Now, it's kind of, if this thing had been even under r goes to minus r, that would be actually very useful because in this trace, you know, we know that the answer is going to be it's going to be some Lorentz tensor, right? Because this whole thing is Lorentz covariant. It's got to be something built out of Q. It's, at the end of the day, it's a function of Q, and it's got two indices of mu and nu, and you can actually see that it's symmetric under that under mu plus nu. So we're looking for something which could be proportional to A to mu nu, or something proportional to Q mu to Q nu. But we're not going to get something proportional to Q mu. With nothing else. So something in the integrand, if the denominator has an even under r goes to minus r, a term in the integrand like r mu q nu is going to have to be zero when you do the integral over r, because you can't be getting a something linear in a vector when you're finished. So it's worth a while to make this thing even. And it's not even because of the cross term between r and q in the denominator. So there's a trick called the Feynman trick. The goal. Make the even under RMU minus RMU, because that's going to make the trace easy to think about, and the integrals easy to think about. So the observation, this is the Feynman trick. It starts with the identity that 1 over AB is just the, it's an interesting way to write 1 over AB. Let me give you the simple statement of the first, is the integral of the integral from 0 to 1 dx, 1 over ax b 1 minus x squared. So the way to prove that identity is just to do the integral, right? It's like a mixture of the right? Four-factor integral relation. So to do the integral, right, it's just the integral 0 to 1 dx of 1 over a group of the x's. It's a minus b times x squared. So if I call that u, so du would be a minus b dx. This is the integral u divided by a minus b of 1 over u squared. And the limits are going to be when x is 0, u is b. And when x is 1, u is a. Right, for that integral, you can do. That's just 1 over a minus b. The integral is going to be minus 1 over u, b to a. And so that's a. So it's 1 over b. That's just a minus b over ab. The a minus b is canceling, so that's that. Right, so it's just a stupid thing. But the point of that is that if you apply that to our denominator, so if you write 1 over d, that was 1 over r squared plus n squared minus I epsilon times r minus q squared plus n squared minus I epsilon. Think of that as a and that's b. And the integral from 0 to 1, you get 1 over. So we want to have this times x, so we'll have r squared plus m squared times x. Now we have r minus q squared. So here we have And press, I just want to group terms now, right? So I've got, I'm rewriting this denominator. So I've got, if I group the terms, I've got r squared, I've got x, I've got 1 minus x is just r squared. I've got q squared just with a 1 minus x. But I, let's, the cross term here would have been minus 2 r half q 1 minus x plus q squared 1 minus x. I might have actually preferred to have this big x one and this thing 1 minus x. Let me just see what makes my life easier. Yeah. Let me do it the other way around just to make the algebra a little easier. Doesn't get symmetric or a equal to b. X. Now we've got m squared, 1 minus x, plus x is m squared, 1 times. Right? So what's nice about this is that I can complete the square. And I can think of this as being r minus something squared. And then I can do the shift of integration variable in r to make that into something which is just a variable that I like squared. So I write r squared minus 2 r dot qx. That's r minus x cubed squared. Because I've got the q squared wrong now. So I have to subtract x squared and q squared, right? So the denominator becomes, square bracket becomes r squared or r minus x cubed squared. Now the q squared, they've got minus x squared plus x, or plus q squared, x, 1 minus x. And so the plan will be, I'll call r minus x cubed, let's call that r prime or r hat. And then we'll just shift the integration variable. So that we'll write p for r. It's just a shift. Q is just something which is an external variable. So it's, there's no Jacobian. It's just p for r hat. But everywhere in the numerator we have an r, we should replace r is equal to r hat plus x cubed. Right? That's what we should do. And once we've done that, where's pi mu? Is it there? Pi mu has now become minus I squared integral d4 r hat over 2 pi to the fourth. Our denominator, I'll just write it out now explicitly. It's, oops, we've got an integral dx still. Integral 1 dx. This x is called the Feynman parameter because it's his trick. Now the denominator is, it's this thing squared. So that's r hat squared plus q squared x 1 minus x plus m squared minus I epsilon squared. In the numerator, we have to take this thing and shift r goes to r plus x cubed. So we're going to have trace of m minus r hat plus x q hat slash r x q slash mu minus I r hat slash, now r minus q will be plus x minus q. Right? So now we can do what I said before. Now, as far as r hat is concerned, the denominator is even under r hat plus minus r hat. So I can drop anything that's not quadratic in r hat in the numerator because the integration region is from minus infinity to infinity. It's symmetric under r plus minus r. So any cross terms between r's and q's dock. So we can drop cross terms of the form integral d4
r hat divided by the denominator times, you know, r hat mu, any other vector like q mu, that's something which is, that integral has to be zero, because this is, the integration is all over in a symmetric region of where r goes to minus r, and this thing is anti-symmetric, this integrand is anti-symmetric, and so because of that, the integral is not zero. So when we expand out this product in here, it's going to be easier to do, right? There's several things that are working in our favor. We know that in expanding the product, just looking at the Dirac traces, we have to have an even number of gamma matrices in a Dirac trace to have it survive. So the mass on this side cannot combine with the R slash on this side, because that would involve, you know, 1, 2, 3 gamma matrices. So we have to have the mass of the mass, and this with this. But in this with this, we can forget the QR R terms, because those things are going to die because of this. So we can also drop the M R slash terms in the trace. So those are also zero. That's going to leave us with R is going to be square root integral 0 to 1 x integral 2 to 4. I'm going to not call it R hat anymore, I'm just going to call it R again. So now we have the numerator becomes, I just have to follow the R's of the R's and the Q slashes of the Q slashes. So I've got minus I with minus I is going to give me, well, let's do the M's first. We've got to get M squared gamma mu, and then we have minus gamma nu R slash gamma mu R slash minus gamma nu X Q slash gamma mu X Q slash. That's the first observation, that you make life simple for yourself by doing this Feynman trick. The next thing is you can make life simple for yourself by using Lorentz invariants. That the integrals we're doing here have the form of, we're doing integral d4r divided by the denominator, which is a function of r squared only. And then we have things that don't depend on r, or they either have two r's. So we have, so we either just do this integral, call it i1. Well, we have I2, which is the integral d4r divided by the denominator of r squared of r mu, r nu. But we know that this thing is a number, right? It doesn't depend on, or you know, it could depend on q squared. So this could be a function of q squared, because the denominator depends on q squared. The ones who've got the r mu up here, there's nothing in the numerator that depends on q. So it's a Lorentz scalar. The q squared dependence is all scalar. There's no dangling mu index or nu index on the q's. So that means the mu nu index here has to be it has to be a tensor not filled with a q. So the only tensor we can make with two indices that is not filled with a q is this a to b nu. So this thing has to be proportional to a to b nu. And the proportionality constant we can get by taking the trace. So if we take the trace of this thing, we're going to get 4 times whatever the coefficient was. Take the trace of this thing, we're just going to get r squared here. So I might as well write this as being, this is equal to 1/4 a to b nu times the trace. It's the integral d4r, called I mu nu, just the indices, over d r squared. You see what I've done? I've just taken the, because this is proportional to the, basically the unit matrix, I can just, if I evaluate its trace, I know the whole matrix, because it's just the trace times this thing. The trace of this thing is equal to the trace of this thing, but I know this thing's proportional to A to B nu anyway, so that means that once I make the trace of the same, that's the answer. So there's only two integrals to do. There's this integral without any mu nu's in it anymore, and there's this integral. And so those are the ones that we have to figure out how to integrate. And that's where the next trick comes in. Let me write what that is again so you
see it in one line. So before I write the next one, I have to tell you one thing. So we're going to have to do these integrals. And the problem, so the first thing you have to ask with these integrals is, do they converge, right? So basically what we're integrating is the denominator, possibly with an r squared in the numerator. So if we, let's look at this one first. You know, this integral d4r, the tricky thing about the integral d4r is that we have this I epsilon running around in the problem. And it'd be easier to think about this if we didn't have to deal with that. So if you think about what that I epsilon was doing, in that denominator, we have basically r squared plus, for the purposes of the integral, there's some constant. Let me call it capital N squared minus I epsilon is the denominator of that squared, where m squared for me means little m squared plus x, 1 minus x, 2 squared. So as far as the integral is concerned, it's some fixed thing. Now this thing, remember, so 1 over d is really 1 over, if I write this out in terms of the time and space parts, remember that's minus r naught squared, plus 3 vector r squared, plus m squared minus I epsilon. So this is going through 0 at when r naught squared is equal to r squared plus m squared minus I epsilon. And if I plot that on the complex r naught plane, what the I epsilon is doing is taking that, when I take the two signs of the square root, the one positive square root is going to have a small negative imaginary part. But if I have the negative square root, the overall negative sign is going to go through and make that into a small positive imaginary part. So what the I epsilon is doing is telling me we're integrating along this axis here, and the answer we would have gotten, if the epsilon had been zero, we would have had a singularity on our integration contour. And what the epsilon came to us from, if you remember, it came to us from the time ordering prescription of the S matrix originally. And so it's told us that there's actually a specific way to integrate around these poles, which is the right answer. And if we do, you know, both these things above or both below, that's the wrong answer. So what it's doing for us is just making sure that we get the singularities in the denominator done properly as we do the integral over, say, the energy of the virtual formula. Now, rather than keeping the epsilon around, it's very convenient. If we're just trying to avoid those poles, as long as we deform this contour in a way which doesn't cross a pole, then we have the same contour as long as everything at infinity as long as the contour from infinity is contributing zero. At infinity, this thing is going like r to the fourth. So d4r or r to the fourth is going logarithmically with r, and that's good enough for the contour of infinity not to matter for the purposes of what I'm going to say. There's a divergent piece here we're going to have to deal with, and I'll deal with it in a second. The really interesting dependence on all the other variables is in the finite part, and that's something which is, you'll see, falling off faster than 1 over r to the fourth for large r. And for it, the contour infinity really is convergent. So it's convenient to take this integral that we want to do on this contour and rotate it and do it on this contour. Because we're forced to rotate that way because the obstacles were these two poles we wanted to avoid. We couldn't rotate the other way without hitting those poles. So that rotation to the imaginary energy axis is called the Wick rotation. And you're forced to go counterclockwise because of the position of these poles, which is dictated by the epsilon here. And so that rotation means that what we call P0, which is now going to be I times, we call it P4, if you like, or it's P, it's the, you know, we're now integrating along the contour, which is pure imaginary. And it's plus I times, if we're going from here to here, top to bottom, you have a plus I here rather than minus I because we rotated everything that way. If I take 1 times I, I go to here, whereas 1 times minus I would take it here. That's the sign here is what I'm telling you when I tell you that we went it that way. So that gives us, the beauty of that is that that gives us now an integral where the shape of this thing is the same. We just forget the I epsilon now because there's no poles on our integration axis. So let's do it here. Let's do it maybe on another board. So the integral, you know, we're, the integral we're trying to do is integral d4r of r to the 2n, let's say, because this n could have been 1 or 0, the two integrals we're trying to do, divided by d of r squared. That was the integral dr naught d3r of r to the 2n divided by d r squared. And if I do this Rick-Wick rotation, it becomes integral I times integral d4r Euclidean. I'll say what that means in a second now. R to the 2n d r squared. Where now, I could write this as being r squared Euclidean to the n. Where r squared Euclidean now means, it used to mean, you know, r squared was minus p0 squared plus 3 minus p squared. But now, because of the fact of I here, we've got plus p0, p4 squared. Plus p squared. So it's really the Euclidean sum of the squares of everybody. And this is where you see the metric is a nice metric to have. If we had had a metric where this is a plus and minus, 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 we would have gone to minus the square or something. And all our squares here would have been negative, which just, you know, bends all the neurons in your brain so you'll never find a sign again. So we're left doing a Euclidean integral up to a factor of I because of this quick rotation prescription. And it's just making the singularity simple to deal with because in this signature, you know, the denominator is nice and well behaved because we've explicitly chosen a contour which is not anywhere near the singularities in the integrand. So the integral we want to do here is just so it's convenient actually. We had a minus I in front of the whole thing. So let's just carry that one around. Originally we had a minus I here. Or maybe not. Let's just live with the I, and then it's going to poke that I up again here. See? So we're doing the I times the integral r Euclidean squared n divided by, and I'm just going to write the denominator as well. So it's r squared m squared. I don't need to find the I epsilon. And the Euclidean space, that's an easy integral to do. Modulo the fact that it diverges, right? So for integrating, the angular integral here is easy to do now because this is now a vector in four Euclidean dimensions. And the integrand only depends on the magnitude of that vector. So we'd be crazy not to use polar coordinates here, right? So if we apply integral, you know, there'll be an r cubed dr. If r is now the magnitude of this four-dimensional vector. And then we have r to the 2n divided by r squared plus m squared to the squared. And now r is just now an ordinary variable. It's not a vector squared. Time is the interval of the angles, d2 omega, over the solid angle in four dimensions will be a three-sphere, right? So the thing is, this, you can just do that integral once for all. The way you do that integral is you, the simplest thing to do is to integrate, you know, if you integrate e to the minus an n-dimensional vector over 2, dnx, you can integrate the total integral here, you can think of this as being the product of e to the minus x squared over 2, the one-dimensional integral, dx to the n power, because if I think of this in rectangular coordinates, it's just the product of a whole bunch of independent integrals. And I can integrate those things, and so it's just some answer, it's 2 pi to the n over 2 or something like that. On the other hand, if I do this in polar coordinates, I'm going to get x to the n minus 1 dx times e to the minus x squared, which is an integral I can do, times the volume integral I'm trying to do of the free sphere. And so by dividing by comparing those two sides, I can even read off what the volume of the sphere is. So let me just tell you what the answer is when you do that. So it's 2 pi n over 2. So the answer here is 2 pi n over 2 divided by gamma. I'm giving an answer for an n sphere, and we specialize any sphere. And I just want to make sure I'm talking about n. N here is not, n here, I'm giving you an n before in this case, so I should really say that this is. Same thing that's in the pod, yeah. This is, unfortunately, now I'm using n, but let me be more careful here, because it's not this n. So, volume of n of a k sphere is omega k. It's 2 pi to the k plus 1, 2 pi to the gamma k plus 1 to 2. It was proven in the way I described it there. So just check, let's check that for so k equals 1, that's a circle. And you know the gamma function is just gamma of z is the order of the gamma function. So gamma of an integer plus 1 is integer factorial, you know, blah, blah, blah. Yeah, I guess gamma of z is, you can define it as the integral 0 to infinity dt of e to the minus t, t to the z minus 1. That's one way of defining it. So you see that for simple values of z, you can just do this integral. So it's something which is a known thing. In particular, though, if so omega, so k equals 1 is a circle. Omega 1, if I got this right, should be 2 pi to the 1 plus 1 is 2 over 2 is pi, divided by gamma of 1. So gamma of 0, gamma of 1 is 0 factorial, which is 1. Gamma of 2 is 1 factorial, which is 1, and so on. That's just 2 pi. So this, the volume of the circle is 2 pi. You know that. You have a 2 sphere. The solid angle for a 2 sphere should be 4 pi, that's what we're expecting the answer to be. So this is the k equals 2 k, so we're going to get 2 pi to the 3 halves, divided by gamma to 3 halves. And what you need to know for gamma is that gamma 1 half is the square root of pi, and gamma of z plus 1 is z gamma of z. So gamma 3 halves is going to be, that's 1 half plus 1, so it's going to be 1 half times gamma 1 half, which is 3 pi. This is 2 pi to the 3 halves divided by 1 half root pi, that's 4 pi. That's the way this, the volume of the 2 sphere is. What we want is a 3 sphere. A equals 3. That's going to be 2 pi to the 3 plus 1 is 4 over 2 is 2, divided by gamma of 2. Gamma of 2 is 1 factorial is 1, so this is 2 pi squared. That's just done once and for all. 2 pi squared. But I'm going to come back to the having an n dimension in a second here, because what's left is this is one dimensional integral, and the thing that sucks is that it's the integral from 0 to infinity now. And the 0 end is fine because m squared makes everything nice and well behaved as r squared plus 0. But the infinity end is a problem, because if n is 0, then you see that we would have dr over r, because r to the fourth here and r cubed here. If n is 1, then it's worse than that. We have dr, we basically have r dr. So that means that when n is 0, this thing diverges at infinity logarithmically, and when n is 1, it diverges quadratically with the ultraviolet cutoff. So this is ultraviolet divergence. about this meeting, it's this limited set of problems. Now, what people did in the 60s was they just literally did that. They cut this thing off. And there's a lot of bad things that happen when you cut an integral like this off. But you can do it if you want to. If you want to regulate this thing. But what you'll find is that when you just cut this thing off, this is now on the side. Because this is not what we're going to do. Because ever since the early 70s, people stopped cutting things off because cutting things off is just making life hard for yourself. So if you cut this integral off, things go bad. So there's several levels at which you can go bad. So what does cutting it off mean? One thing we could do, the naive thing, is we just take this interval and just stick it cut off. So if we say, so case number one would be, we take the integral from 0 to lambda squared, dr squared, stuff, equals something. If you do this, something goes bad that you might not have bargained on, because the answer you get in this case will depend on, we made a specific choice in the original graph, which should still be here. We made a specific choice as to what R was, right? R was the momentum flowing in this line. You could ask, what would we have done if we made R the momentum flowing in this line? If we kept the S integral, could cut it off, and you get a different answer. And it's not even true that the dominant piece as lambda gets large is the same. They can differ. You get what's called rooting dependence. It depends on exactly the integration variable you're integrating in the other day was some line in the graph. If you just start cutting it off randomly, then the answer you get will depend on which particular line you chose to regulate. So that's kind of silly. So the answer depends on which internal line you chose to integrate. Keep as integration. The bottom line will be that it doesn't make a difference what you do. You're going to get an answer, which a piece is divergent and a piece is not divergent. And once you're careful about identifying what the non-divergent piece is, it's not going to care what the divergent. You won't have to actually worry about what the divergent piece was. So you can do this if you want. It's just that you'll make life hard for yourself a long way. The second thing you do, one way to implement a cutoff, which is does depend on how you route things through a graph, is you could imagine cut things off by modifying the action, modifying L. So, for example, if we had had if our Lagrangian had been a scalar field, so we had d phi squared minus 1/2 d phi squared minus m squared over 2 phi squared. Suppose now it's a theory, or a non-interacting part of the theory. If we'd added a piece here like minus 1, what do? We do minus 1/2 d mu phi squared, say. That has the effect of essentially, it's 1 over this thing. The internal lines in a graph are really, if you wrote this thing as being phi times some quantity pi, the thing that's appearing on these lines is essentially 1 over this quantity. It goes to 1 over that in momentum space. So in momentum space, this was phi p squared plus m squared pi, right? So up to the I epsilon, this thing, the thing that's appearing between the phi's here in momentum space is what we had in the denominator of the propagator. So adding this term, what it does is it makes this thing into 1 over p squared plus m squared. Let's say we have a 1 over, if you make the dimensions work, we'd have to have a lambda squared or something here. We've added two derivatives. So we'd have plus p to the 4th of the lambda squared. And that's going to help because for large momentum now, instead of falling at 1 over p squared, the propagators fall at 1 over p to the 4th. So things are going to converge faster, so that would make these things start to converge. There's two things that are iffy about this. One is that you can always write this thing. You can always write this thing as say C1. If this thing is a quadratic function of p, and so it has two roots. And you can always write it as p squared minus a1 plus c2 over p squared minus a2. for some choices of A1, A2, C1, and C2. But the main thing is that it's always true that one of C1 and C2 is negative. And if you think of this propagator as being the time-ordered product of two operators, the way we've been doing, and you insert a complete set of states here to evaluate the way we've been evaluating it, you'll see that the answer has to always be positive, because that's really saying that the matrix, you get a matrix element squared in the numerator, and that thing has to be positive. And so if you had a sensible quantum mechanics, the propagator always had to give you something with positive numerators. And the fact that one is negative shows you there's something funny in this particular, if you really kept this thing in your theory. But you might not care, because you might say, well, we're going to take lambda, it's going to be a convention anyway, it's not going to be a big deal if we get something which, if the sick one goes away, as it must, and we could worry about that later on. A bigger problem is that you can see that if you put derivatives in a gauge theory, for electromagnetism, everywhere you have a mu, a derivative of a field, we're supposed to really get the derivative of fields with a coupling to the electromagnetic potential, right? We always got derivatives appearing together with gauge fields. And if you start adding derivatives like this without gauge fields, then that's not going to be gauge theory. So you're going to find that the symmetries that you needed in the standard model to make the unitarity and Lorentz invariance work are going to start failing for you because your regularization of your integrals is going to make it look like a string. In the end of the day, you can always, once you get the finer parts of things, you'll see that it all works, but it'll just be very hard because all the symmetries in your problem are going to not be explicit because you calculate things. So in the old days, people did this anyway because that's all they could do, but there's a better way to go, and that better way to go is a way of regularizing these integrals, which is manifestly gauge invariant and manifestly preserves all the symmetries you'd like to preserve. And that's the last trick I want to show you. So I'm going to tell you the trick, and then I'll do the integrals maybe in the afternoon. So the trick is, it's called dimensional regularization. Is the regularization of choice. So you're trying to do integrals of the form 0 to infinity, you know, d for r of r e squared to the a divided by r e squared. You're actually doing more general things than this. You can do more general things than this, but I want to show you how it works in the integrals that we're looking at. And our problem is that these integrals for a sufficiently large are divergent, right? So let's say we were, the point is that we wanted to see what this would look like in n dimensions. In n dimensions, we would have had the integral 0 infinity of dn re, re squared to a and so that's going to be, again, the volume of an n minus 1 sphere, which we know is in there, times, sorry, this is, I should have minus infinity. This is the interval in rectangular coordinates. So. Times the polar integral, r to the n minus 1 plus a to plus 2a. So in n dimensions, the bigger n is, you know, the worse this gets as far as the divergence goes. But if you're a theorist, if you just think of this as being an analytic function of the variable n. So regard this analytic function of n, where n can be complex. It's complex. You know, at this point, it's just some sort of a parameter in the integral, so you're always free to do that. This you can also do because it's just a power. It's a power, and it's a gamma function, and these things are perfectly well defined for any complex k. Okay. But the point is that if n is sufficiently negative and real, these integrals all converge like crazy. So in the complex n plane, so the integral for any fixed a and b converges if n is sufficiently negative. So what you'll do is define this thing, we call this I, thinking of it as n as being a complex variable, by analytically continuing the result, the finite results that turn negative n. So in the complex n plane, you know, down here somewhere in the large negative real n, everything converges. No matter how, and it's not going to care what the imaginary part is, really, as long as the real part is sufficiently negative. So I don't know how familiar you are with analytic continuation, actually, that's something which I could ask before. Do you do complex variables when there's uncredits, or are you happy with analytic continuation? The idea of analytic continuation is that if you have some domain in the complex plane, you know, here, let's say you've got one function is defined in some domain like that, another function is defined in a domain like this, but they overlap. And the idea is that if you have the only analytic function which is zero is the zero function. So, and you can imagine if you had the zero function, the difference between so you have F1 defined here, F2 defined here, and the difference, and the overlap, if F1 and F2 agree on the overlap, let's say they do, then F1 minus F2 is zero on the overlap, and it's analytic, they're both analytic. But the thing is, the only analytic function, if you have an analytic function which is zero on an interval, then it's basically zero everywhere, right? Because it's Cantor series. If we said that we had an analytic function which is defined in this whole area, and it was zero in this area, I could do the Cantor series around this area. By assumption, it's going to converge in this whole region because it's analytic. But it's a zero, you know, I know what the Cantor series is for the zero function, and all its coefficients are zero. And if I sum that series, I get zero. So the analytic extension has to be zero. So if these functions agree in this region and they're analytic, then what that means is that their difference has to be zero for the whole region, which means that these functions are the same in the whole region, given that they were the same in this region. That's the argument. So if you have what it says is that if you have any definition of a function in one region, there's a unique extension to the rest of the complex plane as long as it's analytic. And so here I can define, the problem here is that the integral I'm doing, or the sum I could be doing, the integral is defined here. The integral not even defined up here, but what I'll do is I'll define it as being the analytic function which agrees with the answer of the integral down here where it converges. And then because it's analytic, it's unique. And so that's a way of defining the integral. And then I'll just look at the answer when, I'll take that unique answer and I'll approach n equals 4, and I'll ask what it looks like. And you'll see that the function we're going to get is going to have a full of n equals 4. And n equals 6, and all the even ends that are positive. And that's the sign that the integral we're really doing is diverging. But what I'll have to do is then to identify the divergent part is I'll just identify, it's got a simple pole there as a function of n, I'll just identify that pole and get rid of that, and what's left will be the finite part. So it's a very convenient way to pick apart the divergence and the finite part. So that's the logic of dimensional regulation. And in the afternoon, I'll just this thing. You can write this down once the problem is because it's basically a gamma function or a combination of gamma functions. And the gamma functions have well-known poles, and you can just explicitly do the Lorentz expansion and identify the finite and the divergent terms. And those are the three tricks of calculation. There's the finite parameter trick, there's the width rotation, and then there's dimensional regularization as a convenient regularization scheme. And then the only other thing in loops to follow is the normalization. So once you've identified the divergent part, how do you actually calculate the implications of the finite part for physical things? You know, how do you get rid of it? How do you follow, how do you interpret the infinite part of the sense? That's the job that you have to do. Any questions with that?
I just had a question about it's brief. I can ask it afterwards, but it's just about this last line up here.
Yeah.
How did you get into the addition, and how come the that factor of one of the P minus T is not squared?
Which line are we talking
about?
This line here?
Yeah,
I don't
know.
Oh, you're right, there should be a factor of 1 over 2. That's what you want to see, right?
Yeah. So how did the eta and mu come from?
That was, because in the, I still have it here, that's that.
Oh, it's one of the first?
Yeah, the first term is the graph without the back polarization, the second term is the back polarization. I just, well, I want to identify what's new in the loop graph that wasn't in the tree graph. So I owe you money. Yeah, thanks. So we're down in the main auditorium again in the afternoon. That's three.